You are listening to a sermon by Willard Metzger, recorded on Sunday, November 15, 2015, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, it is good to be with you. I have been here once before. I think maybe it would have been 2007. Maybe I'll guess something like that. So it's been a while. So it's good to be back with you. I want to invite you to maybe begin on the back page of your bulletin, and you'll see at the very top there, the green would be our vision statement. This is what is shared with congregations across the country. And with Mennonite Church USA as well. This is our shared vision statement. Let's read that together. God calls us to be followers of Jesus Christ, and by the power of the Holy Spirit, to grow as communities of grace, joy, and peace, so that God's healing and hope flow through us to the world. I really do like this vision statement, and that is what binds us together, holds us together as congregations across the country. And you are part of Mennonite Church British Columbia. That's one of the five area churches that makes up Mennonite Church Canada. And so together we are hundreds of congregations, tens of thousands of people gathering in almost every time zone, worshiping together in 20 different languages. So it is quite a remarkable family of faith to be a part of. And it brings me pleasure to be able to bring greetings from that family of faith. And even more specifically, at our general board meetings, Dori Zurb-Cornelson asked me to bring greetings from her and her husband, Rick, that were part of this congregation, I understand, for a number of years. So she said, please do say hi to the good folks there. So I bring greetings from Dori. Well, in a magazine entitled Missio Dei, a number of years ago, Palmer Becker wrote a very interesting article entitled, What is an Anabaptist Christian? And it's really, his article is really had quite some readership, and it's been developed since then. But in that article, Becker offered three summary statements of 16th century Anabaptism. And that is, Jesus is the center of our faith, community is the center of our lives, and reconciliation is the center of our work. I really like them. I like those three summary statements. Jesus is the center of our faith, community is the center of our lives, reconciliation is the center of our work. I think this does seem to stand in contrast, however, to a North American culture that has become shaped and formed by an ideology that seems to be reaching its limit. The theory of maybe what we'll call continual expansion, fed by the devouring of an endless supply of goods, has been the prevailing economic model. Now, our world has largely ascribed to this theory. If economic growth has faltered, the solution has been to increase the appetite of the people so that they consume more, so that they purchase more. So consumption has become the foundation for sustained economic success. Yet, as the economic world is now reminding us, growth is finite. Consumption has its limits. Resources do come to an end. The earth can be spent until we're all broke. Penniless, with no more mineral deposits left to form our coins. So somehow, we must learn to live with less. Somehow, our global economy must learn to exist with a reduced rate of consumption. This will not be an easy lesson, but I think it is an inevitable lesson. Well, not surprisingly, those still needing something in the future to consume have become nervous and agitated. Young adults have dismantled powerful governments. We've seen this ferment of disgust seeping across the globe, whether from the Arab Spring begun in Egypt to the Occupy movement in London and Wall Street, to the Idle No More, the unrest, the student unrest in Quebec, or the Umbrella Revolution in Hong Kong. There is a new generation of global citizens that are demanding more equitable global systems. They are not content to leave things as they are. It would appear that a global reorientation is in progress. And this global change will have an impact on the church as well. We're all inhabitants of this earth, so whatever global dynamics occur will have an impact on us as a church as well. For decades, the church in North America has emulated the economic context of growth. Religious experience was offered in churches across our cities, like giant box stores. Congregations morphed into large one-stop shops for divine connection. Suburban parking lots on Sundays resemble shopping crowds on Boxing Days. Like the economy surrounding us, church life reflected the market values of need and demand. There's a congregation in Winnipeg that has a drive-through prayer stall. So as people commute home, they can drive up and have their prayer request and then just keep on driving through again. Now please understand that these comments are not necessarily intended as a critique. They're offered as a description. Nothing more, nothing less. As congregations in Mennonite Church Canada, we remained largely unimpacted by these dynamics. We did not develop into mega churches. But it's not for us to feel smug or pious. In a religious system that instructs us to make disciples of all the earth, there is nothing inherently holy about resisting growth. But having said that, I do think that individual dreams have become the evangelical church illness. And as we said earlier, we're a part of that world. We are part of EFC, Evangelical Fellowship of Canada. But it seems particularly the evangelical church infected with American opportunism, the evangelical church has become captivated by grand visions of spiritual success. There is little room for sacrifice, much less suffering. To be a sacred hero means to be a template of divine favor. It's like God looks down, plucks out the faithful, and flows through the obedient to achieve miraculous and marvelous things. And one of the evidences of this influence, I think, is found in the way we have commonly viewed this passage in Esther, particularly the phrase, "For such a time as this." That phrase, "for such a time as this," is usually synonymous with glorious achievement and success. It usually conjures up visions of producing notable accomplishments and having an exceptional impact. This phrase is not used in anticipation of a sounding failure or a robust collapse. This is a phrase associated with successful heroism of historical proportions, "for such a time as this." Now, admittedly, the story of Esther did end in success, but to lift this phrase out of the full context of the story is to miss the richness of the lesson. In fact, I am going to be suggesting this morning that this phrase may be particularly relevant to us as 21st century Anabaptists. Who knows but that we have come to our position in Canada in this period of history for such a time as this. Well, the story of Esther takes place during the time of the Persian Empire, when the Jewish community were spread throughout the vast empire and beyond. The Jewish community was disjointed, fragmented, separated from one another, and no doubt feeling somewhat abandoned by God. Xerxes, the king of Persia at the time, became angry at Queen Vashti following an action by the queen that the king found unacceptable. And that's a whole nother story. But the king's anger resulted in Queen Vashti being removed from her royal position. In time, King Xerxes began the task of finding a replacement for the dethroned Queen Vashti. He searched throughout the kingdom and ended up selecting a young orphan girl named Esther. Esther had been adopted and raised by a man named Mordecai. The king did not know that Esther was a Jew when he selected her, because Mordecai instructed Esther to keep her nationality a secret. King Xerxes became very fond of his new queen. However, trouble occurred in the kingdom when Mordecai refused to bow in respect to the new prime minister, Haman. Haman became furious with Mordecai, and when Haman discovered that Mordecai was a Jew, he enticed the king to order the extermination of the entire Jewish community throughout the Persian Empire. King Xerxes was still unaware of the connection between Mordecai and Queen Esther. So Mordecai implored Queen Esther to speak to the king and to secure a reversal of the edict for the genocide of the Jewish people. Queen Esther reminded Mordecai, and this is where we picked up the scripture passage, that she could not enter the presence of the king without first being summoned. She would be sentenced to death immediately if she approached the king without being summoned, unless at the precise time that the king would notice her, that he would immediately extend his golden scepter. The extension of the golden scepter signified an overruling of the death sentence. Understandably, Queen Esther was hesitant to jeopardize her standing in the palace, much less risk her life. Who wouldn't enjoy the context of the palace? But Mordecai was relentless and sent further word to Queen Esther, saying, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house that you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish." And then comes the statement, "And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this?" Well, several aspects of this story need to be noted. Mordecai repositioned Esther's place in the palace. Rather than as a stroke of good luck or as an individual recipient of God's grace, Mordecai redefined Esther's presence in the palace as a context of divine responsibility. It was like Mordecai was saying, "You are not in the palace for your own benefit. This was orchestrated by God for a purpose that is beyond you." And then, as a way of reinforcing this corrected understanding, Mordecai suggested that God would rise up someone else should Esther fail to be obedient to God's intent. In other words, this is not about you, Esther. This is about the intention of God, the plan of God. See, too many dreams of success center on the benefit of the individual doing the dreaming. Even within the context of the church, it is easy to attach personal satisfaction to the activity of God. There's a personal gratification in extending the grace of God to someone else. It makes me feel good when I am able to positively impact someone else. But Mordecai placed obedience within the realm of God's intent and plan. It isn't about whether or not this makes us feel good. In fact, according to Mordecai, Esther had a responsibility to put her favored status in jeopardy and to risk her very life. This is the context of these famous words, "for such a time as this." This was not an elder uncle trying to encourage a shy youngster. This was not the words of a friend trying to bolster the confidence of a timid friend. This was a push into danger. These words were a call to be ready to lay down your life. Who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this to offer your life? Well, I think this should cause us each to pause and to ask ourselves, what particular context might we be in as individuals? In our friendship networks, our family networks, our workplace environment, school setting, neighborhood, What particular risk might God be calling me into as an individual? To stand up for something, to say something, to challenge something? But today, I want to look at how these words might apply to us as 21st century Anabaptist Mennonite congregations, communities. You see, as history would have it, the persecution of 16th century Anabaptists came to an end, and the remaining movement continued to live, but not before many people who deemed obedience to God to be of greater value than their livelihood and safety and lost their very lives. But here we are, hundreds of years later, we find ourselves as the bearers of the Anabaptist vision. Like in 16th century Europe, we find ourselves in a time of great ferment. In 16th century Europe, peasants were revolting against a disparity of wealth. Landowners were extracting unjust taxes, and the church had become entangled in the extraction of wealth, and respect for the clergy was decimated. There was a political revolution occurring, and alongside this political unrest, the church was experiencing a reformation. Well, today, we are seeing global dissatisfaction. There is increasing demand for a more just distribution to wealth and greater equity for the ability to acquire wealth. The consumers are beginning to question their appetites. And as people look for answers, they are noting that the bulk of the North American church is found within the context of wealth. As part of the consumer fabric, the majority of church folk are found in the middle to upper middle class segments of society. Now again, this is not a value judgment, it's simply a descriptor. Religious researchers are suggesting that we are at the cusp of another Reformation-like shift in church life. The disparity between an ailing world and many of its inhabitants and the socioeconomic security of much of the church is being noted. And there is a growing call for change. I acknowledge to you, I am also part of this disparity. But in the midst of this context of spiritual restlessness, political dissatisfaction, economic nervousness, and societal anxiety, we find 21st century Anabaptist Mennonite communities, keepers of the call for radical discipleship, a commitment to community, and a centered focus on Jesus. Could it be that God moved Anabaptism into North America precisely for such a time as this? If so, then like Esther, this is not a message to make the quiet in the land feel good about ourselves. This may be an invitational call to jeopardize our palace environment and to put at risk our own comfort and security. Young, developing church leaders, students, are discovering Anabaptism by accident in their historical theology studies, and they are recovering its emphasis. In a recent conference that I attended looking at the future of the church, a leader of another denomination was speaking of this great paradigm shift that we are approaching. And then when asked at the question and answer time, well, what should congregations be doing? How do we prepare ourselves for this great paradigm shift that's going to be happening? He responded by saying, become Anabaptist. Become Anabaptist. When a youth with a mission base in Winnipeg, Manitoba, began to sense a call to plant a church, and he was an avid blogger, so in the blog he was writing, I really feel God is calling me to begin to plant a church here in Winnipeg, but it'll have to be an Anabaptist church. Anybody know where I can get connected to some Anabaptists, he writes. Fuller Theological Seminary in California is developing a department of Anabaptist studies because there is so much interest in Anabaptism. Prior to becoming Executive Director of Mennonite Church Canada, my role with World Vision Canada included doing a lot of traveling with Tony Campolo. And Tony, as you know, has consistently been calling the church in Canada and United States to a greater alignment of applying the gospel to issues of poverty and social justice. And he was fervent in his call to action. And there really has been an awakening occurring, I would say, particularly in evangelical churches. In the past, a lot of times they would say, you know, evangelical mindset would say, we're about preaching the gospel and evangelism, and we allow the other social justice agencies to be concerned about those things. But that is now coming together, and that dichotomy no longer carries weight, I think, for two particular reasons. In my role with World Vision, again, traveling across Christian expression, across the country, it seems to me that the Canadian population has two clear expectations of the church. The first is that the church gets along. Even non-religious people know intuitively that if it feels like congregations, denominations of the church is competing against itself, that that's wrong. If congregations are competing, that's just, I don't even have to believe in a God to just recognize that that just doesn't seem right. And the second is that the Canadian population, I think, has a clear expectation that the church should be on the front end of addressing issues of poverty and social justice. Again, even non-religious people know intuitively that if there is such a thing as a divine being, and the church is to be that representation of this divine being, then they should be on the front end of addressing issues of poverty and social justice. And not only is the Canadian population demanding that the church be there, but I think our own young adult population, youth and young adult population in our own congregations across the evangelical church, they're not interested in just carrying on the same form of congregational life as we know it. They want to be a part of something real and vibrant that is really making a difference and on the front end of addressing real life issues. And so I think pastors across denominational spectrum are being pushed. They feel the push from society saying, get out there. And their own youth and young adult population trying to pull the church out. Get us out there. That's where we need to be. So there really is an awakening happening, particularly across the evangelical church. And Tony was fervent in his call to action as we would travel together. He was excited about this. But he would constantly be challenging me as we would go from Pentecostal, Alliance, across the spectrum. He would say, Willard, in this great awakening that is happening, where are the Mennonites? You should be leading this revolution, this spiritual revolution that's occurring. And I don't see the Mennonite church. Where are the Mennonites? I tell you, the Spirit of God is moving. If we do not lift up the Anabaptist understanding of the gospel, others will gently take it from us and live out its call to radical discipleship without us. Perhaps like Esther, the challenge is being laid before us. God will rise up others if we falter in realizing the intent of God. Across Canada, I am seeing an increasing attraction to Anabaptism, especially among the young adult population. Well, I mentioned this a couple years ago to faculty here in Columbia Bible College in Abbotsford, and one of the professors corrected me by saying, it's not so much that young adults are being attracted to Anabaptism as it is that they're being attracted to Jesus. And Anabaptism, with its focus on the life of Jesus, fits that yearning so well. As benefactors of a commitment to radical discipleship, let us rise up to our historical responsibility. We need strong congregations, courageous leaders. We need audacious Mennonite communities who are fearless in living out and proclaiming the gospel. We need communities and families committed to simple living, but as a spiritual discipline designed to promote economic justice and challenge the reckless earth-decaying consumption. We need Mennonite business leaders to continue to model a pursuit for profit that is as much about generosity as it is about personal gain. We have such models, and the church is stronger because of them. But friends, this is now the time. This is the time for Mennonite business leaders to forge a bold new direction and apply their entrepreneurial savvy and experience to the cause. We need students and young adults and newly retired people to find fresh ways of making radical discipleship a compelling vision. Now please, do not misunderstand me this morning. This is not a denominational sermon. This is not a call to increase denominational loyalty. This is a call to maintain and strengthen the integrity of true, passionate evangelical faith. Menno Simon said, "True evangelical faith cannot lie dormant. It clothes the naked. It feeds the hungry. It comforts the sorrowful. It shelters the destitute. It serves those that harm it. It binds up that which is wounded." Quite frankly, I am tired of governments violently invading countries and articulating that action as reflecting or protecting Christian values. I am weary of popular Christian communicators advocating for the enjoyment of wealth while largely ignoring the poor and disadvantaged. And even more disturbing is when these Christian communicators say that such a platform of disregard is the result of God's blessing. Such misrepresentation of Christianity must not go unchallenged. So this is the time in history when the Anabaptist perspective once again has an important voice and role. Increasing global tribalism needs the Anabaptist challenge and witness of loving God by loving your neighbor. Reckless consumption needs the challenge of the Anabaptist Mennonite practice of simple living, but as a spiritual discipline designed to promote economic justice and global generosity. And the uncontested assumption of growing militarism needs to be confronted by the Anabaptist Mennonite commitment to peace. Both in Canada, around the world, we need 21st century Anabaptists ready to re-establish a vital expression of God's grace. Our understanding of the core of the gospel is simple as that three-statement summary developed by Palmer Becker. Jesus is the center of our faith. Community is the center of our lives. And reconciliation is the center of our work. This compels us to embrace costly compassion. It persuades us to risk gutsy grace. And it convinces us to display sacrificial generosity. And I tell you, this is the gospel people want to see. This is the gospel people want to experience. This is the gospel people are ready to embrace. This is our history. This is our calling. This is our time. Perhaps we are here precisely for such a time as this. Amen.